My name is Jason Spies. I'm with the Crude Life, and really this is a four speeches over the last 5 years put into one. And there's a few new things added, of course, because it has been updated, but the purpose of this is just to kind of give you an overview of the ESG conversation that's going on right now as we speak. And I think you're going to be amazed at how far along this ESG industry is, and you'll see what I mean by when I say it's an ESG industry. So when we take a look at ESG University, what is that? Okay, ESG. Some of this may be very basic to you and a repetition of what you already know, but we're just going to kind of go over this a little bit to set the framework. And if anybody has any questions at any time, raise your hand or shout them out. This is about engagement back and forth. And there is no correct answer with ESG right now, and we'll get into that after a bit. Basic ESG overview is the E is for environmental. The criteria considers how a company performs as a steward of nature and demonstrations of industrial integrity. Now, the S is for social. That's criteria that examines how it manages relationships with employees, suppliers, customers, and the communities where it operates. Governance deals with the company's leadership, executive pay, government contracts, third-party audits, government affairs, internal controls, and shareholder rights. So when you look at what we're talking about, is we're talking about three very subjective things. But they are going to come out with some rules on this next year. That's when the subjective becomes more, this is the way it is now. So what is ESG University? This is a place where we like to have some critical thinking and conversations about what is already here. The ESG framework provides an opportunity to align corporate, global public health and development goals to take on a shared responsibility of advancing health and prosperity for all. Again, that is filled with subjective platitude type language, but people like it. Investors like it, and it's what's catching on. And so, how can the industry create the narrative that is going to be acceptable to the average person? That's really what this conversation is more about today, because at the end of 2022, the SEC has said they will have ESG scores. An ESG score or an ESG ranking, it's got some different names, but the SEC has come out and said that they're moving ahead with this criteria. But there's no criteria yet. So ESG performance ratings and reports show investors a company's efforts to mitigate risks and to generate substantial long-term financial returns. So they're looking at the long-term goals here as opposed to the quick return. There's a little bit of a shift that's happening there. The dot-com movement kind of brought in that quick IPO, get rich type of a thing. So this actually tries to balance that a little bit. One of the things that they also say is that a robust ESG program can open up access to large pools of capital, build stronger corporate brand, and promote substantial long-term growth benefits between companies and investors. I don't know about the middle one in terms of building a stronger corporate brand. That's more up to, I think, to the people and how the message comes across and their intentions. But I do know that there are large pools of capital that are open. In fact, in 2019, pre-COVID, when the downturn came and Whiting Petroleum laid off people, Chesapeake laid off people, this was pre-COVID, we were getting hit. We actually went to the bank for a line of credit, and the bank rejected us because our receivables were tied to oil and gas. This is 2019. So fast forward to today and take a look at what they're talking about now on Wall Street, and we're going to get to that in just a second here. All right, so examples of ESG. You can see up on the board there, they've got everything from no poverty to no hunger, good health, quality education. Again, these are things that we all can get behind. These are things that industry has really been doing all along. If you go to any oil community and go talk to the emergency manager, they'll spend 4 hours with you talking about how oil companies not only are building roads to places where tax dollars are not going, but how the volunteer firefighters are getting jaws of life and getting new equipment and having their electronics upgraded without getting any sort of subsidies. These are volunteer fire departments. So there's a lot of this ESG stuff that the oil and gas industry specifically have been doing for their whole industry, well, as long as they've been around. So examples are emission management when it comes to environmental. That is actually coming from the government. That is huge right now, is flaring and emissions management. And my understanding is they're going to be looking at either some sort of reductions of rebates or some sort of subsidies to go towards that through ESG. Tree planting, of course, that's another popular one, but that's almost more on the social side than the environmental side, to be honest. Recycling programs, you know, whether it's a water recycling or maybe around your office, it's trash, you know, it's trash or aluminum cans. The social part of it, the community relations, the volunteering, the mentoring, the awareness. I do believe the oil and gas industry probably does this almost better than anyone when it comes to the communities that they are directly impacting. The advice I give right now to the oil and gas companies or the midstream, upstream, downstream, salmon stream companies is that start looking outside of the oil and gas communities a little bit. Maybe some of the outlying areas and start introducing that, because again, these are people who use petroleum products and fossil fuel. So at the Crude Life, we say everyday energy for everyday people. So almost any town USA, as an oil and gas company, you can make an impact, because you are every day when they brush their teeth. 90%, 95%, depends on which study you want to look at, 90 to 95% of what we use on a daily basis comes from petroleum products. So if I live to be 80, let's just say another 40 years and round down, so okay, let's say I live to be 90, there will be probably a 10 to 15% reduction in fossil fuels, if they're lucky. So think about that for a second. That's a huge shift to go 20 years off of an energy source, unless something considerable comes along the way. So the oil and gas industry is not going anywhere, but the rules might change a little bit, and now's the time to grab those rules so that they are at least fair or equitable for oil and gas. Looking at the social side, we mentioned the community relations, volunteering. The governance part, that one might be a little bit tricky because we're talking about transparency, government affairs, shareholder rights. There's a little bit of PTSD in the oil and gas industry, and rightfully so. The oil and gas industry is still defending Exxon oil spill from 20, 30 years ago and the BP spill from 10, 30, or 20 years ago, whatever it was. If you consider that your industry has one major disaster every 20, 30 years and on the return of what it is, that's pretty darn good. And I come from ag, where ag is, there's a lot of looking the other way, a lot of looking the other way for real life things. So I do think that there's a little bit of PTSD to where the more transparent the oil and gas companies get, the more anxiety because of the cancel culture we're in. But also there's a lot of intellectual property that they don't want out there too. So there's going to be a little bit of issue with the governance on the ESG side of things. So I really recommend that the oil and gas industry try to get a hold of that one before it gets out of the way. So these are just some things that we've done recently here. Up in the corner, we sponsored a yoga in the park. Actually, it was yoga in the outfield in Watford City. So what we did is we thought we'd bring in something a little bit different than the oil and gas community normally brings in with the golf events and the skeet shoots and the other things. So we said, let's do yoga. So we brought out, and we've had people that never did yoga in their life. So it was a great time. We also sponsor, like money sponsors like everybody else. And you can see there, tonight, actually, if you guys stick around for the dinner, the national anthem is going to be performed by a local 18-year-old guitarist who just got off the Battle of the Bands Wyoming tour, and he's graduated out like Menudo back in the day. When you hit 18, you're gone. So he's going to Powell, which is, I think, Northwest Community College, to study music, but he's going to perform on his guitar the national anthem before Governor Mark Gordon speaks. And that is going to be way cool. And that is thinking outside the box a little bit, for especially even for a national anthem. So we've actually set up some Make-A-Wish Kids with a podcast studio. We did that 3 years ago up in the Bakken. At the Bakken barbecue this year, we brought in baked potatoes. And this is actually an example of ESG, a minor one, but it's an example of ESG. So when you take a look at a barbecue, it's inherently discriminatory against vegetarians, because there's not one thing that you can eat at a barbecue if you're a vegetarian. All the beans have bacon in them. All the corn has butter in it. Everything, so all the cornbread is made authentic. So you got a real problem if you're a vegetarian. And we live in a world where people show up to yoga, okay? So we brought in baked potatoes at the Bakken Barbecue, so that way we could say everybody is welcome at the Bakken Barbecue. But we went a step further. We went out and got a piece of the DAPL pipeline. So there's a guy in North Dakota whose dad works for a midstream company, and they got themselves a piece of the DAPL pipeline that was left over. He retrofitted it into a smoker. He pulled it up. It says DAPL BBQ right on the side. We smoked our potatoes, and we called them our DAPL BBQ ESG Certified Smoked Potatoes of Inclusion. And we had 9 people work in our booth. All 9 said the same thing. There was over 100 people that came up to our booth, ages 14 to 30, female, that thanked us for having potatoes. Some of them didn't even take the potatoes. They just came up to thank us for just bringing the idea to a barbecue. At the Williston Basin Conference, this idea was so ridiculous. And we took so much fun with it and embraced it for the craptasticness that it was, that at the Bakken Barbecue, Tiffany Steiner, the co-founder, a group went up to her and said, "Did you hear they're having potatoes at the Bakken Barbecue this year?" And she's like, "Yeah, I approved it." We tried to get it in for 6 years. It took 6 years to get potatoes in the Bakken Barbecue because it would get laughed off. And we didn't pursue it. And this year, when they heard it, they thought it was the best idea they ever heard in their life, like they never heard it before. So sometimes reintroducing some ideas that were crazy a few years ago, they're going to work right now because people are trying to think outside the box. We do things like we'll show up and help kids get gardens started. And there's a reason that we use the plastic barrels. We're trying to show them how working together can actually help the environment. So here, instead of bringing in acres and acres of dirt to start their own garden, now they can have their containers and then move them and have it be very cool because they don't need more than, you know, that much dirt for, I don't know, how many is that, 6-7 corn? But it's a great way for them to get together. They now can have an appreciation of that pot and that plant and that sort of thing. So this is another example. Here at this last year at the Bakken Barbecue, we brought in a singer from Williston. And actually, she's quite a decorated singer. We didn't realize that when she agreed to it because she's producing an album in L.A. right now. And we brought kids up on stage, and it's a song about flaring. So now we've got a video with 30 kids up on stage holding candles in awareness about flaring. And we now have that going forward to help show that there are more people out there looking at a common way to embrace both sides. Matt Hill, he's out here right now. He's with Knight Energy Services. He's one of our correspondents. He's out there interviewing people right now about what they're doing for oil and gas. And so that's part of the governance side as far as the transparency and that sort of thing. And then when we did the check presentation, we invite media, we do the big check, and that's I call it ridiculous, but that is part of it. It is having a little bit of showmanship nowadays with social media is a big part of the ESG movement and just everything. These are just some seeds of sustainability we've done over the last 10 years to kind of show you how this body of work has come. So we are non-political. We started out to be non-political. The reason we did that was because everybody is political, including ESPN and The View. You can't even get a sports score anymore without a Colin Kaepernick kneeling national anthem debate breaking out in the middle of the third inning. So it's very different. So we said, hey, we're just going to be non-polarized and see what happens. Well, we found out there was an audience for that. They really enjoyed it. In fact, the newspapers and radio stations really liked it because they started becoming polarizing, but they got to adhere to the FCC, so there was a little bit of value that we brought from a non-political side of things, and so we really increased our distribution. 2014, we partnered with Adopt a Highway, and then the downturn came is when we started an energy youth program, and that's when we started marketing that we were non-political. Well, that by the way, industry did not, they didn't like that. They at that time, it was very much trying to shape the government at that time, and so there was a little bit of beating the heads on that. 2016, we expanded our reach. BBC reached out to us, and we ended up doing some correspondent work for the BBC. So that meant CNBC, BBC, New York Times, you know, these major outlets we've now have relationships with and do some things. Right now we're working on a story with Fox News, actually Fox Business, excuse me. 2017, we began doing our environmental reports because we started seeing this ESG come up a lot more. And I read a Rockefeller report in 2013 from 2012 about ESG. 2012, the Rockefeller Foundation has a report on ESG. So we started reading that a little bit and saw that this is probably a reality. And so we started doing weekly environmental reports with Meridian Energy Group. They're building the Davis Refinery in Belfield, North Dakota, and they're the first greenfield refinery that's going to be built in the United States in the last 47 years. And their CEO, William Prentice, extremely passionate about transparency, especially being the first refinery in 50 years. So we did a weekly update with the CEO, the head of the engineering, or the head of the project manager, or even a local person, every week about that refinery. Because the minute that refinery goes online, it will set the global standard for new refineries, just because there hasn't been a new one in 47 years. So we started seeing the need to do the environmental reports. 2018 increased, 19, we actually entered a, this is so stupid, it's so fun. We entered a tournament, an environmental tournament as the Crude Life. We entered an environmental tournament. And the message was, renewables ain't doable without fossil fuels. And we won, because we were the only non-polarizing entry with the Crude Life. Everybody else had, we love the Eagles and, you know, let's all kumbaya. Everybody had some sort of green or kumbaya name, right? Here we come in with the aggressive name, the Crude Life. We won. So at our booth, if you want to stop by, you can see we actually commissioned a UFC WWE belt, the same company that makes them, that Brock Lesnar wears in the ring. And it's a great way to introduce the conversation to children and people outside the industry. We have pictures all over the internet with people with this championship belt, with the Earth's Championship. We have a dog as a mascot, Frackleberry Hound. See, one of the few times you see somebody smile with the word frack. Another example, we're trying to change the conversation. 2020, COVID came. More partnerships with the international energy experts and media. In this last year, we focused on the industrial forest, which is a different project, and some ESG journalism. Next year, the industrial ecolution is coming, along with sustainable solutions. So that's kind of what we've been planting for our seeds of sustainability. And like I said, this is the first time that I'm actually doing this presentation, but it's really kind of a four part of the last 10 years that I'm kind of laying out here with these seeds. All right, so let's talk about some benefits of ESG, because there are some, and then we're going to talk about some of the issues next. So one of the things that they say, I'm not necessarily in agreement with this, but I do understand where they're coming from, and it does bring an opportunity to manage risk. And it does build trust with stakeholders and shareholders. Transparency always does. Helping oil and gas companies make better informed business decisions. Well, that's true for any industry. In fact, when we did our ESGU in Watford City, this is no kidding, we didn't get one person from oil and gas to show up. We filled the room with people from outside the industry. Real estate, ad agency, healthcare showed up. What was the other one? I was blown away. We limited it to 12, but I was blown away, absolutely blown away. Long-term creation value. Anyway, I brought that up because it's helping other industries too, as well. I just have oil and gas companies there because this is an oil and gas event here. Increase visibility into planning, identification, and management of operational risks. Attract talent. That is something that is true. The younger generation, they want a social cause behind their work now. And this ESG is bringing in a social cause in a new way. So that actually can help the oil and gas industry quite a bit. But again, it goes back to, it's your opportunity to tell the story. And right now it's the ground floor. It is the ground floor of this ESG movement, even though they've been They're ahead of the game a little bit, and we'll talk about that as well in a second. Challenges of ESG. Well, there's an acceptance to integrate it into its operations. Most of the oil and gas companies are already doing this. Most of the midstream companies are already doing this. Most of the salmon stream, upstream, downstream, you name it, they're already doing most of these things. It's just having a template or a table of contents or a structure or a backbone that you're comfortable with. Because like big data, you can go a million directions really quick and bankrupt yourself so fast you won't even know what to do. That's what can happen with this ESG stuff. So you have to really understand what your company's intention is and then go from there. There are learning curves and growing pains, and I just named that. You know, it's you're going to spend money in ways that you've never seen before. I mean, think about the social side of things. How many people sponsor events that don't get the return that they want out of it? That's you know, that is a growing pain. You go back at the event next time learning, well, maybe I'm not going to go out and spend $300 on dinner. I'll just spend $200 on whatever the thing is. There are some cultural business norms, too. And the reason that is important is because we're talking about host communities. With ESG, they're talking more international. So if you were to look at ESG from a national company, they'll tell you, if you want to do business in Japan, ESG is going to help you. That's true. But I look at it as, if you want to do business in Midland, Texas, or Greeley, Colorado, or Watford City, well, maybe ESG will help you there too. Because if it's going to help define some of these things, and the cultural business norms are going to be into play here, well, that's an opportunity for these local communities to step up and say, we want this activity here. We want the business here. Because that can be played into this too. This has not been decided yet. The government affairs, the transparency, like I said, I think that's actually going to be the biggest challenge for the oil and gas industry. Understanding inclusion, diversity, and awareness. So the example I gave you earlier about the barbecue about is inherently discriminatory. I didn't even realize that, actually. It's just one day I started thinking about it, about, oh, what can we do this year to add something new to the barbecue, and that's when I brought the potato idea. And then over years, I started thinking more and more about it because I started looking around, and one year, I counted there was only one cooker out of the 28 that actually had something that a vegetarian could have. So that's it took a while for me to really put this through. So it took me a while to understand the inclusion and the diversity of just a barbecue. So when you take that to other places, you know, you start thinking of your social media posts and you start thinking about that whole world and whether it's including and whether it's excluding and is it a country club and is it open to everybody? And these are the conversations that a lot of people are having right now when it comes to inclusion, diversity, and awareness. And then there's the other challenge is being proactive rather than reactive. Right now, I think the industry is being a little too reactive and they need to be more proactive. And the difference between proactive and reactive is The Daily Show by Jon Stewart, that was a reaction. That show was 100% reaction. There was nothing proactive about The Daily Show except the conversation, which was proactive. So when you react to something, you're already on the losing side. You're already on the losing side. So I think the industry needs to get proactive on things. And again, Frackleberry Hound is a ridiculous example, but it's working. The crude life gets invited to schools, parades, all kinds of places, that street fairs. And our name is The Crude Life. I mean, we're not hiding who we are. It's extremely aggressive for a name. But with the Frackleberry Hound and just the Earth's Championship belt and these things that are kind of ridiculous, that is connecting with the average person. This is actually no lie. Earhart, Minnesota, 4th of July. We partnered up with a local ag company, RDO dealership. RDO, they're a big Midwestern dealership. They're McDonald's number one potato supplier. So we partnered with them, and we rode on the top of a water sprayer, one of those big 80,000 gallon or whatever, not 80,000 gallon, water sprayers, and sprayed the crowd with recycled water. It was regular water. We called it recycled water as an awareness for recycled water for the oil and gas community. And this was in Liberal Blue Lakes Country, Minnesota. Kids loved it. We got videos, all kinds of stuff. We had a professor from Minneapolis, the bow tie type, you know, actually offer to donate money to the Crude Life. That's when I went, oh, wow. Okay, there's something behind this then. If we can connect, if we can figure out a way to connect with people who are normally against us. All right, so who's ever heard of an ESG ranking? Anybody? One? Good, this is going to be very eye-opening. Carbon Click is not us. This is one of the 47 different sites that I found that do ESG ratings. Did you know there are people out there already ranking oil and gas companies with ESG scores? So if you're sitting around the dinner table and you're talking about investments, people are pulling out their phone and going to Yahoo Finance or wherever and pulling up ESG scores. Keep in mind, ESG scores, there's no validity behind them at all. But guess what? They're already out there, so I guess there is validity behind them. This is what Carbon Click and pretty much everybody else uses as their formula. And if I know the way the internet works, one person did this and 1,000 people copied it, because that's kind of the way the internet works. But as you can see, they do kind of have some pillars and themes that go with the ESG score, the social governance, environment. So like under environment, it says climate change, ecological footprint, resource use, and pollution. There's actually more than that, but those are the ones they do. So here's what you have. So if you go to Yahoo Finance, you can pull up EOG. And their ESG score is 39. And it says high underneath. And they're in the 83rd percentile. Well, and then they actually break down the environmental risk score, and they break down the social risk score and the governance risk score. I tell you what, the first time I saw this, I went, who the F do these people think they are? Like, this is billions of dollars being impacted here because some guy clicking and clacking on his keys put something out on the internet and a bunch of people said, good, our morning meeting said, go get an ESG score. And they went and did it. I have no idea how this all started, but if you go take a look on the internet, there's honestly, it's maybe one or two, and they all just copy each other. So Phillips 66, they have a 33, which is lower than 39, but they're in a 67th percentile, but they're still ranked high. What does this even mean? Well, then Continental Resources. Whoa, 99 percentile. I know what that means. Well, I know what severe means, and the language. The language, are you kidding me? Severe? They could have picked anything. They could have put platinum. They could have put needs improvement. They could have put puppies, kittens, anything. They chose severe. That told me these guys are serious. They're serious. If they're this far ahead of the game and they're coming out with this crap already, wow. That is unbelievable. I mean, I was taken back. I actually had anxiety whether to put this slide up or not. Just because the first time I saw it, it about dropped my heart. I didn't realize how far along this was. So what does this mean? All right, what does this mean? Well, it means that a new climate and ESG task force was installed in the SEC division of enforcement this last March. How many people knew that? One again. Two. Oh, all right, we got one more in the room. How you doing back there? Two people. That tells me a lot, too, because there's been a lot of news out there. In fact, Steve Harvey just gave me news at the gas pump today. Think about that. Us content and news providers now have to compete with the gas pump for content. Used to be the taxis. I'd walk out of a hotel in New York, and I'd see the sports score go across a taxi, and I went, well, no reason to watch the news later. I already know who won the Knicks game. Now it's going to get gas. I got Steve Harvey telling me who I should pay attention to. No, actually, excuse me, I'm in the media, so I'm going to vent for a second here because I've got the mic. They're going to tell me how to feel. The media likes to tell me how to feel. As an award-winning journalist, I get a little upset about that they no longer report. They like to tell you how to feel. All right, so now I'm going to step off my 50-foot barrel of oil drum here, step back down. All right, so in June, because they paid attention to what happened in March, 16 state attorney generals, one who we interviewed, actually two we interviewed, Leslie Rutledge from Arkansas and Attorney General Wayne Stengem out of North Dakota, they submitted a letter by pushing back against the SECs, but again, as far as we know, it's still moving ahead. Now we got 16 states, we need more. So if you're in a state outside of these 16 and you like fossil fuels and petroleum products and don't want to go on a crash course from 95% of a quality of life down to something below 80 within the next 2 years, maybe you might want to reach out to your governors and things like that and just ask them, what do they think about this? You don't even have to tell them what to do. Just ask them what they think. Start the conversation. So what does this mean? In my opinion, here's where ESG is. It's on the 1 yard line with 99 yards to go. But we're only in the first quarter, and the refs haven't even brought the rules or the ball out yet. But both teams are on the field, and the game's going on. And that's the reality. The game has already begun because economies are being impacted. Businesses are being impacted. New economies are already starting. To me, that says the game's already going. So that's why I keep saying right now is the time to set the narrative. All right, so what do we got next here? This is something where I again, had some anxiety on this too. But back in 2019, I was up here on stage. I shared it with several people, and I said two comments. One was that I believed the oil and gas industry was going down the template of the public health smoking ban. And they were starting to position oil and gas companies as the next big tobacco. And I also said I believe that YouTube and Instagram is a much better way to reach kids than talk radio and television, okay? So that's what I said back in 2019. So before I came out here, I just did a quick search because actually I was saying this in over a dozen oil and gas operator meetings over the last 2 years. I said those exact words, and it did not go well. That was something that they didn't want to hear, and it's something that I probably regretted I'm saying in the moment. But it's very difficult when you live in Fargo, North Dakota, which is the Boulder, Colorado of the Austin, Texas. Very difficult when you talk to a coffee shop owner who is from Williston, North Dakota, and Sydney, Montana, who worked in the oil and gas industry to save up enough money to go start their dream of a coffee shop called Thunder Coffee. Bison, go Thunder, Thundering Herd Bison. By the way, Coach Craig Bull set up our program and then set up your program here in Wyoming. But they call it the Fargo nose wrinkle, where they no longer say that they work in oil and gas because people stop going to their coffee shop. So it's very similar to that. So I did a quick search before I came on here. I just put big oil. I didn't even do tobacco, and that's what came up. This is what came up. So the Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, CNBC, and something called The Verge, these are Politico. These are companies that are already comparing the oil and gas industry to big tobacco. And again, this is the time to get a hold of the narrative before it gets out of hand. Because really what it is state-sponsored shaming. They're grabbing something. And I said this, by the way, I'm a non-smoker. And I stood up for the smokers because it was a legal product. And I do believe in some sort of rights and that sort of thing. Now, also, I agreed with the ventilation and the public health and everything along those lines. But at the end of the day, all they were doing was state-sponsored shaming. They were turning smokers into the modern-day lepers. If you go see anybody under the age of 50 smoking, people don't like it. They don't, and they'll go up and say, don't do that. So they're back in the back alley with the modern-day lepers. And I saw it in Fort Collins back in 2014. Because in 2014 and 15, I spent a lot of times in Fort Collins because it was easier off the interstate to go to Denver and Greeley. Well, when I was staying in the breakfast bars, I would say, you know, I work in, or where do you work? And then they'd look over their shoulder before they say oil and gas. It's 2014 this was happening. And then, of course, we all know what's happened in Colorado. The state-sponsored shaming, and that's nothing more than rank discrimination. And again, this is rank discrimination, what's going on here, folks. Using children as experts. Imagine if you're the climatologist that went to school for 25 years, and you finally got the keynote speech at the climate summit in Paris that they do every year, only to be usurped by a 16-year-old girl as the expert in climatology. Wow. Wow. What's the point of going to school? What's the point of going to school if you just have a little bit of a marketing machine behind you and you're now the face of climatology? That is incredible, folks. That is a well-orchestrated machine. And here's how they did it. Emotion over attitude. I'm sorry, that emotion and attitude over facts. That's, here we go. And it is emotion over attitude. I'm not sure if that's a typo or not, because it was late when I did this. But what's happening is that emotion and attitude are replacing fact. And the word frack is a great example, actually. When the word frack came, there wasn't any problems with the word frack, because it was understood it was a scientific term. Well, as the industry started becoming emotional, and the environmental climate activists, I don't like calling them environmentalists, because actually I am an environmentalist. I have adopted a highway since 2004, and I have a number of things that make me more of a qualified environmentalist than any climate activist out there. So what they did is they started attaching emotion to their cause, because when you go outside, it's very easy to connect with the environment. Oh, the trees and the save the whales and whatever it might be. It's very easy to connect. So when you start using emotion and attitude over fact, what happens to the word frack is that you fracture a dam, you fracture a bone, you fracture a relationship. There's never been a positive connotation of the word frack. So all of a sudden that gets used against the industry. My first conference I went to was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. They bring in all the heads from the Federal Reserve and all these, it's like a rare albino elk sighting. Like, these are people that you maybe see once a year on some Charlie Rose interview, right? I mean, this is like unbelievable. And the first speaker, he got up there and he said, we could have gave billions of dollars to Madison Avenue and we could have said, come up with the worst word possible for our industry, and they would have came back with frack. And we did it to ourselves for free. And he was doing that more for shock effect, but the example I gave to how it kind of happened over time is more the reality. But he's right, because that word does get used against you quite a bit, against the industry, because I'm part of the industry too, is it gets used against us because there's not a positive in the language. It's fracture a dam, fracture a relationship, fracture a bone in anybody's history. So that's why, again, we do the Frackleberry Hound thing to try to see if it works, and it does. People smile when they say the name. First time I've ever seen people smile with the word frack in a long time. Polarizing and politicizing science is another way that they're controlling the conversation. I'm just going to be very brief on this because I'm looking at the clock and I don't want to go too long because I do know how much time I have left on the slides. I do not believe politicians and lawyers should be dictating science. That's all I'm going to say on that. Industry spent billions on PR. We all know that. Okay. When the reality is we've been training green for 150 years. According to Jesse Ossebeller from the Rockefeller Institute, the industrial nations have been decarbonizing their energy sources for over 150 years, meaning that we are moving away from carbon towards hydrogen. In other words, the ratio from carbon to hydrogen decreases as you go from what we originally had was wood and hay. We would go out in the forest and we would burn wood. We'd have leftover hay, we'd burn hay. Well, that was a one-to-one ratio to where now, I'm sorry, not one-to-one, but it was the worst there was. And you can see that from coal, it has the dirty brown or the dirty black carbons, and oil has that, to all the way methane gas. One carbon atom is pretty damn good. That is really good considering we stopped killing whales. I mean, there are certain things that have been happening for 150 years that happened long before Greta Thunberg came along. The oil and gas industry has been trending green long before the Sierra Club came along. And the oil and gas industry needs to take back this narrative. And they have the body of work to prove it. Science is about exploration and change. Renewable energy is a political term. Nuclear is renewable energy. You never hear about that. Hydro is renewable energy. Technically, nobody ever talks about hydro. They only talk about two different renewable energies. Biomass is one of the worst renewable energies, and that's the one they use the most. So renewable energy is a political term. Policies are being created more and more to create issues and debt, actually. So when you take, and Yellowstone is a perfect example. I implore you to read Chase Alton's book on Yellowstone. It is a horror story of what the U.S. government has done to Yellowstone National Park. An absolute horror story to where they almost extinct the wolves and the cougars, only to find out they screwed up and it was the elk. So then they try to get rid of the elk. I mean, it's the most unbelievable, to where they have raw sewage being dumped out of there right now. Okay? And these are the people with total control and big budgets. So there's a quite a history there. And as I mentioned, you know, we've been decarbonizing long before Greta Thunberg came along or the Sierra Club. All right, now, wind farms are not green. I just wanted to go a little bit further on the renewable energy because I do actually get a little bit political when it comes to wind farms. And it has to do with the birds, the bees, the bats, the eagles, the whales. Because when you take a look at how the golden eagle is almost extinct now in the Southwest because of wind turbines, and Germany now is taking a look at their insect population where all their wind farms are, have decreased by 70%. Again, I come from ag. According to the government, birds don't matter, but bats do. Bats mean a lot to a local economy. In fact, if you take a look at the way that the wind protesters are advancing their work against local economies, it's through bats, because farmers need bats as pollinators and they control insects. So bats are very critical to the economy. And the problem is right now with these wind turbines is they have a homing device that the bats go right into them. The bats fly right into the wind turbines. The eagles get smacked on the way around, and the birds and the bees and everything like that. Whales are even having problems with wind turbines out in the ocean too, they're finding out. So, but beyond that, when I take a look at the the wind industry, they don't have a reclamation program. So we have no way to recycle them. We have no way to reclaim the land. When the wind turbine is done, it's the landowner's problem. And I've driven by enough barns to see them dilapidated to where if a bird were to land on the barn, it'll fall over, to know what a lot of these landowners are going to do. They're just going to leave the wind turbine up until nature takes care of it and gravity wins. And so in 20 years, in 10 years, we're going to have to invest $40 trillion in another reclamation program that they're not fixing now. And they know this. This is not new that there's no reclamation program. They have no way to recycle the wind turbines. Iowa said we're full. South Dakota said we're full. Idaho got caught. I think it was Idaho. Idaho got caught because some community was saying we'll take them, and the state said we can't. So there's all kinds of new issues being brought up, but they're still subsidizing these things to be built left and right. I truly believe a farmer from 100 years ago was more advanced with wind energy than we are today. And what I mean by that is a farmer and his neighbors could put up a windmill, get water, and power a pole barn in a day, maybe a weekend, and they're done. Okay, well, that's renewable energy. That works. But what we've got going now for wind farms, that's not even close to what they were told. And by the way, a lot of this is coming off of 30 years of not hitting milestones. So we've invested trillions of dollars, close to $1 trillion, into wind energy, and they haven't even hit their milestones once in 20, 30 years. So it's kind of different that you keep giving money. And these are their milestones, not ours. There are noise pollution problems. We had a state legislator from Fargo, big wind champion, big wind energy guy. Well, he got invited to go live in a house next to a wind turbine. And he's a former pastor. And he does not like wind energy anymore. No longer. He stayed for one night, and he understood what the people were talking about. So there's also deforestation, the subsidies, and then, of course, the reclamation issues. All right, I'm going to step back down for a second. So verified science, consensus science. I would like to go back to that for a second, too, because that is a big part of this, okay? Consensus science is what climate change is based on. Again, we're trying to get a hold of the ESG narrative here, so it's good to understand what consensus science versus verified science is. Consensus science is 4 out of 5 dentists approve Lucky Charms. 5 out of 6 dentists approve Trident gum. That is consensus science. That's not regular science. Regular science is that if I take this reusable water bottle and I drop it from the Camplex arena here and send that equation to 15 scientists across the world, I'm going to get back an answer that is very close to a precision within each other. There's not one model that does that in climatology. There's not one to think that you can predict the future like that is asinine. So there's a difference between consensus science and verified science. The other thing, too, is that there's no double-blind studies that I'm aware of in climate science. There isn't drugs. What a double-blind study is that you grab different laboratories that don't know each other, they have no idea what's going on, and they're doing the same study. And what happened in one, this is one example that happened in 2009, I believe it was. Two random people living thousands of miles apart were in a random airport, and I think it was Atlanta, Georgia, because it's one of the big hubs. They started talking about, oh, what do you do? Oh, I do this, I do that. Well, through the course of conversation, they learned that they were working on the same study. It was for a drug, I think, by Pfizer. Well, through the protocols of what they did, they had to go back and report. I was in the airport, ran into so-and-so. This is what the whole study got scrapped, millions of dollars gone out the window because the study was now contaminated in the eyes of the FDA and some of the regulatory bodies. If double-blind studies existed in climate science, we wouldn't be having this talk right now. I even put that down there. I wanted to make sure I said that. So bad policy is actually more expensive than correct science. And a single study now sets policy. So we don't even have double-blind studies that set policy. Trillions of dollars being set off single studies that are special interests and everything else. So, and then tax research is not even available to the public anymore. These are issues that are real issues. Consensus science historically is driven by lawyers, politicians, and special interest groups. And that's why I wanted to make sure I really hammered that home. So are we moving away from verified science to consensus science? Is that what ESG is? Is ESG going to be more verified science that if 4 out of 5 dentists say this is the way it's going to go, then that's the only thing we're going to invest in? All right. Historical fear campaigns, power lines, cancers, Y2K, global cooling, peak oil, population explosion. I'm going to go through this real quick just to let you know how the media works, because this is a big part of it too. Y2K, for example. Y2K was interesting because that was a 2-year blip. If you go and do a NexusLexis study or a search, which is by terms in the media and newspapers and et cetera, and do Y2K, you'll see a spike in a graph over like a 2.5-year period, spike, spike, spike. Well, the first part was the doomsdayers, people saying, true story, Washington Post, planes are going to fall out of the sky. Banks are going to crash. This is Y2K, right? There was so much fear and hysteria at such a short period of time put out by the media, a doomsday market was created. To where they actually have shows on TV called Doomsday Preppers. That all came from the Y2K, okay? Now, just to give you an idea how that works, Chernobyl. Everybody remember Chernobyl? Chernobyl. Only about 50 people died in Chernobyl. That's roughly about the number of people that die in a traffic accident every day here in America. The reports were 15,000 to 30,000 people were going to die. To actually have 56, that's an incredible error by the media. That is literally yelling fire in a crowded theater, okay? Well, if nobody's going to hold the media accountable but the media, then nobody's going to hold the government accountable but the government. You see how this goes? So in a UN report, actually, this is true. They actually said, and I put suggests, that false information was actually more deadly than Chernobyl itself. More people died from anxiety that their children were going to be born disformed, and anxiety that comes with the radiation, than actually died from Chernobyl itself. So in the media, we got a saying that, you know, when there isn't news, we're going to present it like it is. So just keep that in mind, as there's a million different places to get your media, including Steve Harvey at the gas pump, because a lot of it is filled with words like severe when they're talking about a ranking that's not even approved yet, that's available online for investors to make decisions on. ESG and you, this is basically just a few things we've been doing over the last 10 years. We went out and did a magazine article, energy companies cleaning up. Here's them doing some cleanup in water. Here's some cleanup with picking up the roadside thing. Of course, we've got Crestwood giving $1 million gift during the downturn. That was a very important part of it too, to showcase that they're investing during a downturn. And then also just trying to figure out, you know, some different angles like ag and energy existing and coming up with crossbreeding donkeys with cows with nodding donkeys. I didn't come up with that headline, but it works. All right, next to the last slide, thoughts. ESG is here. How do you want that to look? Because you can be a part of the conversation right now. Call, text, email your oil and gas councils, your petroleum alliances, your state representatives, your banker. Contact your banker and tell them how you want ESG to go. Don't let them tell you. You tell them. You keep the lights on, man. It's like what's happening in the oil and gas industry right now, I saw happen to the farmers. I grew up in agriculture. I saw the grocery store replace the farmer. The light switch has replaced the oil and gas worker. And that is a real problem. I went through so many Sunday dinners and Thanksgivings listening to my grandparents and their uncles, aunts and uncles and friends, farmers, become very bitter because nobody gave a crap about the farmer anymore. Because you just go get ground beef at the grocery store now. I mean, it's incredible. If you want to take a look at where we're going, take a look at California. Back in the 90s, they mandated 2% of the vehicles be EV. And then by 1999, 10%. They actually had a hybrid market that was working. The EV was not being accepted, so that's why they mandated it. I don't believe it's still being accepted, yet they're mandating more. Go to California and find out why people are leaving. They don't want to pay $15 for a pack of cigarettes, $12 for a Big Mac, and $47,000 on a $100,000 house for taxes. California has like almost turned into Europe Junior in terms of cost of living, just on basic goods and services. And a lot of it has to do with government-mandated marketplace. The other thing, how do you protect your intellectual property and your thought workers? Because that is a very interesting thing what's going on right now, because there is no way to protect that. Lawyers and attorneys have figured out a marketplace for the thought worker, but there's not much beyond that. And so you have to think about that in this whole ESG movement with the transparency side of things. And again, that's what I was talking about, the intellectual property. That's on scientific stuff. Just go to like marketing. If you're gonna start throwing out like some marketing ideas, well, that's tough because other people might take them and all of a sudden they might take that momentum and go. So there's a lot of reverse engineering that's going on since the Apple computer, Microsoft Xerox days, but it's happening in other areas. So take a look at that. Anyway, adaption versus entitlements. There's a famous quote that says, the strategy of entitlements favors the elites and adaption favors the average person. I just wanted people to think about that when they think about where subsidies go, where bailouts go, and where they like to direct a lot of their money. Consensus science versus verified science. Again, that's Saturday morning science or facts. And what are you doing right now to improve the industry? Think of what you've done over the last year. I showed you a slide of what I think we've done, and that's only part of what we've done. I think bringing yoga to Watford City improved the industry. I think bringing baked potatoes helps the industry. I think having a weekly ESG report called the environmental report helps the industry. I could be wrong, but we think being inclusive and everyday energy for everyday people help. What are you doing? Just ask yourself that. And here's some things that we're going to be talking about this fall with ESGU, because it will be a weekly conversation that we're having on the crude life. We're going to have guests, we're going to have topics, we're going to have all kinds of different things. It's meant to be a critical thinking platform, because we don't know where we're going with this yet, but we know we got to get there because it's already happening. So we're going to talk about the ESG ratings and scores, kind of like what we talked about, the language. I don't think the word severe should be in there. I don't. I want an explanation why. So we might actually get a little bit in their face on some things with this ESG, because apparently there's some dark room that I don't know about. Decisions are being made, because we've been covering this for 10 years and nobody's reached out to us in these dark rooms and asked us for our opinion. So we're just grabbing the narrative and moving ahead. And we'd like your help. We'd love to have your help with this. The social media policies are coming in 2022. I talked to three people in the last week that said they got memos from it. Social media policies are coming. And keep that in mind. That is part of the ESG. By the way, just to let you know how subjective and wide range the ESG movement can be, they're already talking, and this is not political, this is fact, they're already talking about how they can make sure that you're vaccinated through ESG, whether you want to have business or not. That's the length of intrusiveness that is currently being talked about. And again, I'm not trying to be political. I was just raised where your religion, your sexuality, your income, and your health were private discussions that you and your family had. Now, if you don't talk about that at the dinner party, they want you to go home. You're the buzzkill now, because that's the first thing people talk about. I didn't realize there were so many different genders, but listening to my son and his friends, holy crap, apparently werewolf is one of them. So, all right, so we're gonna talk about the crew shifts and the succession plans that are being happening as well. $100 oil is the new $50 oil, or maybe it's only $40 oil. I truly, truly believe that. And we're going to talk about that over the next 6 months, too. I do think $100 oil is a new $50 oil. Colorado's a great example, because if you got to build a sound wall around everything, $100 oil is not $100 oil. That's a new cost. And if you're not getting it on the back end, it ain't working. There will be more layoffs, mergers, and buyouts coming before 2022. I've heard that from many, many sources that I feel confident enough to put it up on the slide. The new normal in oil and gas is Ag 2.0. If the government is going to be directing a lot of the business now, that's no different than ag. And where I'm from in North Dakota, now they're actually subsidizing oil and gas companies to where they do that in ag, and then Monsanto ended up owning 99% of their vertical. So it can happen too in other industries. In fact, my morning show partner is from Saudi Arabia. He grew up in Saudi Arabia. This is so different. He's never worked in oil and gas in his life, but he grew up living on a compound known as Dahran. It's a crew camp of about 15, 20,000 people. They got schools and golf courses, but the teacher is employed by Ramco, which used to be Standard Oil. So he grew up in Saudi Arabia during his childhood. And then when he was 16, they send you away to boarding school, because if you get caught with alcohol in Saudi Arabia, you're in jail for life. So the oil and gas, but at the same time, on the compound, you can have a still in your secret room. just keep it in your house, you know, type thing. So anyway, he said that he believes we're going down the path of nationalizing. He was a part of two countries that did it. He lived in two countries where the countries nationalized oil. And we've had this conversation with U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer. So this is we're not trying to poke a bear or saying, this is just having speculation type conversations of how bizarre the behaviors have been of the industry over the past, industry and government over the past several years. That's what you mean by the new normal of oil and gas and ag. Difference between proactive and reactive. We're going to talk about that too. And then the knowledge workers and how to define a knowledge worker into their marketplace. Because if this ESG industry is really where it's going to go, then the knowledge worker and thought worker needs to be protected now. Otherwise, they're going to get their ideas taken, and they're not going to have any opportunity. And so, that's what I mean by that. Now, questions or comments? Here we go. That's how I ended, I guess. Very abrupt like that. So that was kind of a lot, I know, folks, and I apologize if it was a little heavy for you. But again, this has been 10 years in the making, and these are things that we've pretty much said before and things that are already happening. So with that, I thank you very much. And does anybody have any questions, by the way, or anything like that? Or yes, sir. So, yes, actually we can. Meridian Energy Group was trying to build the Davis Refinery, basically had to move heaven and hell to try to get investors because of this ESG movement. And it was actually called something else back in 2015 and 16. It had a four-letter acronym back then. ESG was still used, and we didn't know ESMT. I apologize. I can't remember the four-letter acronym, but Meridian Energy Group's an example. I gave you my little example of trying to just get a line of credit to carry me through on 2019 from a bank, and I got rejected because my receivables were oil and gas companies. Yep. During Meridian, it was, yes. I don't want to say that specifically somebody said you don't have an ESG ranking. I can't say that. But if you go back and listen to our weekly interviews, we talk about ESG, how they want it. I mean, everything I just said, we basically have been talking about because as the CEO, he's having trouble getting investors, you know, in a hundred, during $100 oil, you know what I mean? Like, there's a problem here. And there's all kinds of examples, actually, online if you want to do a Google search. One of the big examples they're given right now is Exxon's shareholders. That some climate activists, actually two or three, have become shareholder board of directors now. And so that's going to completely change their entire financial future, I guess. That's just a couple off top of my head, yeah. I know some people have done it to improve their ranking. I know in North Dakota, we have a lot of companies that'll do like butterfly fields next to a highway, you know, to get some PR and that sort of thing. And that's all part of the ESG, that type of thing. But to answer your question, I do not know specifically if that has been said, but I do know CEOs that have told me, yeah, they have a lot of trouble getting investors and banks. We are going to be talking to Kunal Patel with the Dallas Federal Reserve on our premiere week, September 8th through the 17th. A week so big, we need 10 days. Yeah, I know. We got to be corny at times. So he's been doing ESG for several years, so we are going to have a conversation with him about the current ESG and where we're at with it. And that's with the Federal Reserve, and that's out of Dallas. So that'll be available online after it's had. So you had a question? Interesting question. You know, I do not know the origins of ESG, actually. Mm-hmm. And what year was that?
This year.
Yeah. So when we started doing the ESG environmental stuff in 2015, 16, Again, we didn't use the word ESG or EMC. Anyway, the four-letter one that starts with an E, too. We didn't use either one because I just didn't want to. Because it wasn't in the regular vernacular. It wasn't at that point, wasn't part of our daily lexicon, right? But now, all of a sudden, like a memo came out, and everybody in a herd mentality fashion just said, okay, we got to do this now. And it's really frustrating for me because, you know, I've been trying to talk about this civilly since 2015 and 16, and now it's polarizing. And so it's almost harder to have a conversation about it. And like I said, the SEC's already said it's happening. They had you don't have a task force unless you know what's done. It's just like if you want a highway to stick around, you call it a person. The Theodore Roosevelt Highway will be the last one to be defunded because 24th Street is sterile, nobody cares, but Ulysses S. Grant Lane, don't touch that. Same thing with scientists, never name your rats or your bears because eventually you're going to have to cull it or whatever you call it, kill it, I guess, to move it on. But it's really picked up in the last year because the SEC came out and said that banks are going to require it. That's why the increase has happened. And again, this is an example of proactive versus reactive. The industry's reacting right now. And it's such an interesting reaction because the game hasn't even started, but it has. So that's why I say we're on the 1 yard line. Both teams are out there to play the game because there's already scores. Like scores have already happened, you know. But the rules aren't here and they haven't brought the ball yet. So, okay. So you got a bunch of people bringing their own ball and all right, I'll move the clock up myself and do everything else out. So anyway, well, I thank you folks for coming, and I'm not sure what time the next session is.